Hi, welcome to the Beverage Report podcast. I'm Sarah, a third-year economics student at the LSE. Today, we're joined by Dr. Rachel Nye from LSE Economics. She specializes in the theory of economic growth, labor markets, with a focus on structural transformation. She's also my lecturer for EC 301 Advanced Economic Analysis, one of my favorite modules in my third year. Hi, Rachel. How have you been?
Hello, Sarah. It's nice to see you again.
What motivated you to study economic growth and development?
So for me, it was very much a personal experience. I was born in mainland China, in Chengdu, city of Sichuan province. I left Chengdu when in around 1980, and then I went to Hong Kong. I stayed in Hong Kong until I finished my undergraduate. Then I went to United States in 1996. So during that 20 years of movement from mainland China into Hong Kong, into United States, I experienced very big change in the way people live, what I see around me, the buildings, what things people use. And that made me realize there is a vast differences in income differences, because that's what, basically give people the different living standard. So I was always curious to understand why, country have such big differences in their incomes. And that has to do with what were they experiencing over the last 20 years in terms of their economic growth. So that's how I was interested in economic growth. And when I do my PhD, that was my PhD thesis, to understand the income difference across country because of their different growth experiences.
What are the challenges that growth economists are facing?
Challenges, you mean like nowadays or when we are doing it?
Nowadays.
Well, I think, you see, for economists, we have we use a combination of tools. In your economic course, you have to look at the data. You have to think about the intuition, what kind of mechanism is behind. And then you have to design an economic model that can apply it into different situations. So that is basically what we do. I think very often the challenge is whether we can get the data that we wanted to look at, and also how much does the pure economic mechanism can explain what we see. For me personally, I never really well understood the political side of what is happening. Because you could have a very neat economic growth model about all the mechanism that we think about. But if for whatever reason, a war broke out, then it's like everything just come into pieces. Like what we see now, if you look at the news about how all those parts built up in Ukraine, all those buildings, all those human capital, physical capital, everything that has been built up, just disappear. Now that's the recent experience, but in many, African countries, they've been going through years and years of war, and that is something very difficult to understand. So I think, personally for me, one of the challenges really is to understand better the interaction between how the political process interact with the economic growth process. Sometimes how can we set up an institution, a system that can check to prevent one individual can just change the course of development and growth.
What is structural transformation, and why is it so important for us to understand economic growth?
So structural transformation is something that we have all experienced. So if you think about it, like when you graduated, very likely you are going to find a job that is related to service production. Like you might be in the banking sector, in the finance sector, working in the office. But then if you talk to your parents or your grandparents, very often they are working in a factory. And if you talk to your great-grandparents or great-great-grandparents, given you guys are so young, then you will very much often find that they work on a farm. So the structure transformation is simply the process that as economy develop, as they get richer, you have people moving away from agriculture into manufacturing, into services. Now, of course, linking back to what I said in the beginning, because there's such big income difference across country, we still see bigger agriculture share in today's developing country. So this process is going on in all country, but the pace is very different. A Western economy, the developed country, we have seen now the agriculture share has already dropped to about 3%, even though 200 years ago, the agriculture share is more than 50%. But in today's developing country, we see that the agriculture share can still be as high as about 50%. Thinking about the two very fast growth economy recently, like China and India, for example, in China, in the 1980s, the agriculture employment is more than 50%, and today in China, it's less than 20%. So this process is happening everywhere. Now, why is it important for economic growth? Let's go back to the Nobel Prize winner, Simon Kuznets, in his book on modern economic growth. So there he already highlights this natural process come along with economic growth. And in order to gain the full potential of economic growth, you have to let this happen. You have to remove the barriers that is stopping this happening. So if in the economy, we don't need that many people to work in agriculture anymore because the agriculture productivity growth is very fast, then you need to move these resources out of agriculture into other sectors of the economy. If there is barrier to such movement, then these human resources, this physical capital will be locked in the agriculture, and that will hinder the modern economic growth. And so this is why it's very important. It's because it's a natural process. It's unavoidable. Agriculture sector has to shrink in terms of employment because the productivity growth there is very fast. So therefore, to gain the full potential for growth, we need to see the process of structural transformation happening.
In your paper, Time, Use and Gender in Africa in Times of Structural Transformation, you investigate the links between home production and market work for African women. How does structural transformation generate new labor market opportunities for them? And how has their time allocation in home production and market jobs changed over time?
Yeah, so that is one of my very recent work. So let me fill the gap a little bit. So what I just explained it is the relationship between structural transformation and economic growth. What is interesting, you know, in addition to the structural transformation that is happening within different market sector, there's one particular sector that's very important, which is called the home production. So what is home production? Home production is basically there are services that is being produced at home for the use of the family. For example, cleaning, cooking, childcare, all this. Now, what is interesting about home production is they can be potentially outsourced to the market service sector. So therefore, over time, as the market service sector develop, then we don't have to do as much home production. We could outsource it. Instead of cooking your own food, you can eat out every now and then. Instead of doing your own cleaning, you can hire a cleaning lady or you can bring it to the laundromat. You know, all this, there's a way of outsourcing. You know, even recently, people started hiring dog walker. They think of walking dog as part of leisure and part of home production, so they're outsourcing it. So that's one bit. So the home production play an important role, you know, just like the other form of structural transformation. The transformation from home sector to the market service sector, this process will also matter for economic growth and employment. Now, why does women come into this picture? Interestingly, as what we've seen in the data around all the available time use survey for over 69 countries, is that on average, women spend 3 times more time than men in home production. In some countries, it's much more than 3 times, like South Korea and Japan. Women spend much more time. In other countries, there are more equality. Like in Norway, women spend slightly more time than men. But in general, what we take away is that home production primarily use female labor. So what does that mean? That means that as you can start to outsource home production, then women don't have to spend as much time at home to do home production. They can now go to the market and specialize in what they are doing. So think about the situation of Korea. So Korean, you know, women, they are highly educated, at least as educated as men. But what happened after they get married is many of them withdraw from the labor force and specialize in home production. When you think about that, a lot of human capital is kind of lost. Of course, they can teach their kid, but still, you know, you have these women who may be professional, they have specialized knowledge, but they switch to just doing cooking, cleaning, and childcare. The market has an advantage over home production because market benefit from Adam Smith's notion of specialization. Okay, during the pandemic, I realized that, you know, I have to do all kind of home production, and I realized how much more efficient is my cleaning lady than me in ironing the clothes. You know, she's at least three times faster than me because she's specialized. But if a woman has to stay home full time, she has to do many different tasks. Whereas if you can outsource each of one of these tasks, you can benefit from the market productivity. So what we see is over time, when women can start outsourcing their home production, they can contribute their talent to the thing that they really are good at. So that is why it's very important. It's also one of the important components of economic growth. So in this African paper, what we look at is something very interesting. We saw that there are two key dimensions about what is stopping women supplying their talent to the market. So we look at the South Africa and North Africa. In the South Africa, Sub-Sahara Africa, you see that the female employment rate is very high. About 70% of these women, you know, report that they are employed. But then when we look at the hours of work, then we see that the average weekly hour they do home production is much higher than the average weekly hour they do market production. So what they are doing is they are combining this market work, which is employment, with the home production. And why is that? Because a lot of their employment is in what we call, you know, family business. Like, for example, the husband owns a farm, the wife is working on the farm, or the husband owns a little shop, the wife is helping in the shop. So these are predominantly the employment of women in developing country. Okay? They are called unpaid family worker. They're basically employed by the husband or the father, okay, sometimes. So the challenge that face us is, so this pattern I also find in a separate paper, which I look at the United States data from the 19th century. There we find similar pattern. It turns out that the female employment rate was quite high in the 19th century. Then as United States developed, the female employment going through a U-shape. It first declined and it rise. So we believe that this kind of U-shape is something we would expect for the African country as well. In fact, many of them have shown the sign of declining female employment rates. That's the same thing that is happening in China and India. The female employment rate is declining. So what it shows is as these family farm, family business disappear, these women's time will be released from employment. They might be focused on home production for a while, just like what we see in the United States in the 1930s. But then in the United States, they manage to come back into the labor market. So the question is, can these African women also come back to the labor market later on? So that's the challenge. And we use the lesson from the United States to see that there are two main sets of constraints. One is the gender norm, okay? So what is the view about women working outside the home? Because when you work on family farm, you're still staying in the family. So you do a bit of farm work, you do about cooking, home production. But now, if you want to work, you have to leave the home, okay? And that might not happen if the social norm is not allowing it. What we see in the North African country, where the employment rate is very low. So social norm is something that is important. Now, of course, as economists, we are not telling people to change their culture or their norm. But the lesson we learned from the United States is the social norm can evolve when other market opportunity evolve. So the second set of constraints is whether these market opportunity are there, such as do you have to facilitate the sector for women to outsource their home production? So there are some, you know, experimental project which they set up childcare center near the factory for the women to go work so that they can bring their children to go to work in some of these African countries. And also, whether it's safe for women to actually go to work. In many of these developing countries, there's no public transport. And, you know, if the norm was against them going out, they might get attacked when they go out. So, and whether there's infrastructure, like what United States managed to cut down on the home production is, of course, there's appliance coming along, electricity, you know, water, you know, available, you turn on your tap, water come out. But in many of the African countries, they have to go and collect the water and collect the wood. So these are the constraints that is facing for them to, you know, come out to, you know, into going through this U-shape to start to have an increase in employment rates. And it's all deeply linked to this process of structural transformation, the development of the market service sector.
You also looked at China's agricultural sector and labor market. In your paper on China's mobility barriers and employment allocation, you argued that the hukou system imposes barriers to population movements. What are the two main barriers and how do they inhibit the growth of the agricultural sector in China?
So what I used to teach you in the Easy 301 is that you know, China has this amazing growth experience since the economic reform. And it's, you know, very much amazing. And remember, we talk about one paper of Professor Alan Yang, which is an amazing paper. And there he point out one of the very important source of growth is the agriculture sector. So despite all this, we see that there is an amazing productivity gain in agriculture. My paper was trying to show that there could be even more. And what was the logic there is, so that many of you, you know, might be holding a Chinese hukou, so you know better. So one thing about the Chinese hukou is, if you have an agricultural hukou, you got some land to farm for free. But for many years, until, you know, maybe 2010, before 2010, you can farm that land. But if you decided to move to the city to do another job, then there's a risk the village leader will take away the land from you. Okay? So this is one aspect of the hukou that we think is a mobility barrier. How does it work? Well, if you remember your introductory economics, when there's two sectors to work, which sector will you work? Very often we think of the return in the two sectors. And very often we say, we will equate the wage that is paid by the two sectors. So if I go to the factory pay me some wage, and that wage will be related to the value of marginal product labor in the factory. And if I leave my farm, then I don't supply my labor to the farm, so what I gave up is also the value of marginal product labor. So in that world, people's migration decision will be just based on the value of marginal product labor. And that's something we say is efficient. Okay, these two things are equal, so there's no gain. In equilibrium, it's good. In the case of China, when you leave, your benefit is the wage in the factory, just like the other equilibrium. But what you gave up is not just your value of marginal product labor. Because when you don't farm the land, not only that you didn't have your labor in the land that is being counted, you also lose the value of the land because the land will be taken away. And that is basically increasing the cost of leaving the land. And that will generate overemployment in the agriculture sector. However, if you are allowed to rent the land out, okay, then your migration decision will be going back to what the competitive equilibrium say, which is if I leave, I will not contribute my labor in that land, but I can get back the value of the land by renting it to someone else. Okay? So that's why the existence of an efficient rental market is very important in order for this to have an efficient, you know, reallocation mechanism. So this is one aspect of the hukou system. And the Chinese government, you know, really for many years is trying to reform it to make sure it doesn't happen. In the 2004, they have this land contractual reform where they're trying to reinforce the contract so that the village leader should not take it away. But of course, it's always like that, you know, reform take years to really happening in real life. There's the reallocation is still happening. But more recently, we see more people can really rent out their land. So that is improving. But from the 1980s, 90s, and early 2000s is not the case. So that's one aspect. The other aspect of the hukou system, which is like a barrier, is the aspect that if you hold the hukou of a location A, and you go to work in location B, then in location B, you're considered as a migrant. Okay, suppose you go to Shanghai, okay, and you don't have a Shanghai hukou. Then when you are in Shanghai, you lose out on many, many benefits, such as, you know, health or education for your children. You don't get those benefits. So in other words, when you move to Shanghai to work, you are giving up all these benefits you could have get in your origin, location A. And so that is, again, increasing the cost of migration. So we show that these two aspects together is giving a substantial overemployment in agriculture and generate a substantial productivity gap between agriculture and non-agriculture for China. And the good news is, even on this second aspect, the Chinese government is reforming. You know, in some second-tier city, they are now, you know, extending the entitlement of this kind of education and health even to the migrant people.
What are your favorite books, and what books would you recommend to the undergraduate community at LSE?
So I have to be very honest, because of so many responsibility that I have. So I have a son who is 10 years old. So that means I do a lot of home production in addition to my market production. So that means my leisure time is very little. So the reading time is very little. So I haven't been reading many books recently, but I can mention a few books that I have read that I thought I like. You know, I don't know whether you like it, but I thought I like it. So when I was younger, I read the book Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky. I can never pronounce that Russian name, but I'm sure if you type it, you'll find the author's name directly. I like that very much. I like Murakami. In particular, I like his book, The Wind Up Bird Chronicle, which I enjoy. When I say favorite, it's like when I read a book, it takes me away from reality. It makes me go into that world. Nothing really deep philosophical that I really want to push it, but it just takes me away. So more recently, I'm reading, there are two books that leave deep impression on me. One is The Last Day of Socrates by Plato. It's very, very interesting. It really gives you a lot of food for thought. And the last one is a book that I'm reading now, which is the biography of Chopin by Alan Walker, which is, you know, because I had a very different childhood. I was under child poverty. I was a child laborer. So there's not much there. I started working very young, age 10, in factory. Then later on, I basically support myself working in restaurant, tutoring, everything. I always like music, but I never have chance or money to learn. So very recently, now that I have a job, so I have the financial resources, even though time is still limited, but I managed to start learning piano now. And I particularly like the Nocturne of Chopin. So I really wanted to understand what he was going through when he was writing the music. And this biography is amazing. It has a lot of you know, description of all the things he's written, what situation he was going through, what he was thinking when he was writing that. So If you like music, I think it's a very, very good book to read. Yeah.
Thank you. Finally, something we ask every economist we have on the podcast. What gives you hope?
What gives me hope, I think, is to know that there could be improvement over time. There could be less people under poverty. Coming out of Chengdu, you know, over the last, since 1980, so 40 years. So every time when I go back, I see changes. I see things getting better in some way, maybe not every way, but something get better. So as an economist, I do think that if we can find a way to make economics function, then improve the life of people, then that's my, you know, hope to see a better future. And of course, there is a lot of challenge, as we see recently in recent events, and that require people of different field working together, not just economists. There's, you know, all kind of issue we're facing, climate change, you know, mental illness, all these are very important. So my hope is that we can find better way of organizing the society so that people's talent can put to right use, and then the human race can benefit altogether.
Thank you so much for your time, Rachel, for the book recommendation as well. And I hope you have a wonderful time playing with the piano.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you tune in next time.